how does Life After Life, Kate Atkinson's 2013 critical hit, figure into her new novel? Our reviewer Tom Perotta will join us to talk about A God in Ruins.
It's such a strange experience to go from a book where a character just constantly shifted shapes and emerged in new and surprising ways to a book where the characters seem a little bit frozen.
Shirley Jackson was well known for her horror fiction, but what did she have to say about the home front? Ruth Franklin will join us to talk about Jackson's completely delightful domestic writing.
Being a housewife was a part of her persona as a writer, as well as of her actual character. She did in some ways identify as a housewife and enjoyed doing so.
Alexander Alter will share her notes from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Tom Perotta joins us now. He is the author of many books, including 9 Inches, Little Children, and The Leftovers. And this week, he reviews on our cover Kate Atkinson's new novel, A God in Ruins. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Pamela.
You start off your review in an interesting way, contrasting this latest novel by Kate Atkinson with what you consider to be a kind of current, I don't know if trend is the right word, but just this strain of questioning the format of the novel. How is the Kate Atkinson different from a lot of the big books that have come out and gotten a lot of attention recently?
I'm just always surprised in the way that literary trends come and go. And I just remember having this distinct feeling reading the Atkinson that it felt a little old-fashioned, not in a bad way, but it made me realize that something that 5 years ago might have seemed completely mainstream suddenly felt like slightly behind the curve. And again, as I say, there's nothing wrong in literature with being behind the curve, but the avant-garde, or there's been a movement in the novel toward. But I'm thinking of books like Carl Ove Nausgaard's My Struggle. I'm thinking of Jenny Offal's Department of Speculation, Ben Lerner's Leaving the Atocha Station. Books with a single narrator, they feel barely fictionalized. They're memoir-like, they're diary-like. And, these books have been very exciting, and they felt fresh to people, and they felt somehow, I think, closer to a contemporary sensibility. If I wanted to be a little bit snarky, I could say, it's almost like selfie literature. They're complicated, but they're really a photo of the writer.
I think you just coined a new snarky term there with that selfie literature, unless someone else has already done that.
I strategically left it out of the the article.
Selfie lit.
It's fair, selfies seem narcissistic and shallow, and these are narcissistic and deep, if I
right.
can put it that way.
Whereas the Kate Atkinson is more of a traditional big canvas, multi-generational, just the scope of it is more traditional.
Right, and it's the kind of thing that maybe a few years ago you'd have thought, yeah, that's what a novel is. But I think that definition of a novel has been, very effectively challenged by some of these newer books. And so it's just that strange thing where something that once felt normal, you suddenly realize isn't as normal as you assumed it was. It was a convention of a particular moment in time, and that moment may have passed, but it also made me think that, well, that moment, had its strengths. And one of the strengths, I think, is that there's a real engagement with history and a kind of, very adventurous willingness on Atkinson's part to, travel through time in just fearlessly. She'll go from 1925 to 1980, without a breath and without a hitch. It's a really seamlessly written novel.
What's the book about?
So the book is a companion book to Life After Life, which is Atkinson's masterpiece. I think that was the previous book about Ursula Todd, a woman who has many different lives, all set in the first half of the 20th century, and it's sort of about being in England in the World War One and the period between the wars, and then in London during the Blitz. So it's really about England up to World War II. And this new book is about the aftermath of World War II, or it's about World War II itself and the aftermath. And the focus is Ursula's brother, Teddy, who is a handsome, lovable, charismatic man who flies 70 bombing raids over Nazi Germany, improbably survives and lives a long but somewhat diminished life afterward. So it's a book of aftermath rather than a book of events.
You talk about the book, you called it a companion novel, which is what the publisher is calling it, rather than a sequel to Life After Life. And obviously, it's very hard to imagine not having read Life After Life and what that would be like. But try anyway to imagine picking up this book as someone who had not read Life After Life. Do you think it stands alone, or is it something that can really only be read having previously read her 2013 novel?
I would seriously recommend reading Life After Life before reading A God in Ruins. I think that they work best together. And in that sense, companion piece is not, I think, a marketing term. I think it's actually true. You know, maybe it's because I read Life After Life and loved it so much that I can't imagine A God in Ruins separate from it. But I will say, you know, Life After Life is a very dynamic book and it will just sweep you up. This one is a little thornier. It's a little bit slower. Aside from the war scenes, which are epic and amazing, it's a much more melancholy and contemplative novel. And so I would just say, I don't know what that experience would be like because that wasn't how I read it. I read it with already knowing Teddy, already knowing Ursula, already knowing actually, you know, quite a bit about the characters. I don't know what it would be like to pick it up completely fresh. I wouldn't recommend it, actually.
Did you feel immediately sort of thrust back into that world?
Yes, yes. And I think Atkinson did that very strategically. The book opens with just a brief glimpse of Teddy the pilot during the war, and then cuts immediately back to 1925 in a world that the reader of Life After Life would be extremely familiar with. So it almost has that feeling of, previously in Kate Atkinson's world, you know, you're thrust back into this world that you experienced before and know. And if you love that book, you'd be very fond of it. So she's kind of refreshing your memory with that. And then she throws you the curveball, which is to send the story into 1980 and an entirely new bunch of characters.
One of the amazing things about Life After Life was, you know, that Ursula Todd is this character, as you mentioned, who is born and then dies repeatedly in the novel. And so you get all of these, it's just like a sliding doors, multiple sliding doors, where you see if only she hadn't gotten raped, then she wouldn't have become an alcoholic. And now in the next version, she doesn't get raped. And this is what happens to her. So you get all these different alternate realities of how someone's life might turn out. And in the end, you know, there's the dominant narrative that sort of takes you through to the end of the novel. But it's interesting then to have a companion book because you wonder then, well, which reality, which version does this fall into?
You know, without spoiling it for readers, it, what happens in A God in Ruins is that you feel like you're getting the definitive version, that reality is not mutable in A God in Ruins. There is one reality, one history, one war, one aftermath. And so the Ursula that you get in this book feels like the authoritative Ursula, you know, because Atkinson had a multiple number of Ursulas to choose from, and she gives us one of them here. So, and you know, that could be maybe a little bit of a melancholy experience for readers who are invested in, you know, a different Ursula. You know, it's a more playful book than you'd expect, and there's a slight metafictional element to it that's interesting. Life After Life had a kind of a video game strategy, as you say. You know, if the character makes this choice, then this story will unfold. If the character makes this choice, you know, this other story will unfold. And there's none of that here, and so it feels more single-minded and authoritative. And there is a kind of a little bit of a loss in texture in that contrast.
It's like a very grown-up choose-your-own-adventure.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Though also an exciting one because it involves the battle scenes are really the heart of this book, and I would just have to say that it's a real tour de force of historical reconstruction and you know, imagining, you know, Atkinson imagines herself into inside a bomber in World War II, and I found it, you know, quite gripping.
You contrast the two books in your review and say that Life After Life was a book about possibility, about this kind of multitude of different narratives before each of the characters, whereas A God in Ruins is kind of about immutability. And I think that you allude to this in your review, that it's a pretty melancholy novel, and that in large part, it's about England itself. What is she saying about England?
I think that both Teddy and England feel depleted. You know, there's all this vitality in Life After Life, even though terrible things are happening. There's this sense that, you know, the future could be different. And the story enacts that by giving Ursula a multitude of different futures. And in A God in Ruins, you know, it's right there in the title, And absolutely, the book bears it out. Everyone seems to have defined themselves in a way that can't be changed. And that's hard. It's hard in narrative fiction to have characters who are not going to change, who seem absolutely impervious and resistant to change. And I do think Atkinson, if it weren't so much woven into the theme of the book and as a contrast to the previous book, it might feel like, you know, a flaw almost, that these characters feel static. It's like Teddy cannot change himself, and his daughter Viola doesn't seem able to change herself. And it's such a strange experience to go from a book where a character just constantly shifted shapes and emerged in new and surprising ways to a book where the characters seem a little bit frozen.
Why do you think she did that? I mean, do you think it was deliberate?
That's why I think the two books need to be read together. I think there's this sense of history there, which is like in the first half of the 20th century, this family in this country was a dynamic place full of possibility. And then there was this shattering event, the war, which, you know, our characters rose to the occasion and they were heroic. And yet, in the course of that heroism, they lost their vitality and they lost their dynamism and they lost their ability to change. Atkinson may be saying that England lost its future, you know, that the past is what's interesting now. And that's certainly the case with Teddy. He's just not an interesting character as he ages. He's very kind, but he doesn't do anything interesting. His past is fascinating, and the book is really devoted to an examination of that past, but it is a nostalgic book in that sense. The future just no longer seems possible.
It's as if the first book, it sounds like it's primarily about beginnings, and this book is about endings.
Yeah, and ending, you know, she defines it, you know, endings and death are the loss of possibility. Nancy, Teddy's wife, dies young from cancer, and there's just a moment when she's like watching her family, you know, quietly, you know, they don't know she's watching them, and she just thinks this is it. There are no more possibilities. And so Atkinson has done the improbable. You know, she's written a book about there being no more possibilities, which seems almost like the antithesis of what you expect from good narrative fiction, and yet she's created good narrative fiction out of that.
We're talking about Kate Atkinson's new novel, A God in Ruins, but also about her previous novel, 2013's Life After Life, which was one of our 10 best books of the year, with Tom Parada, who reviews it this week on our cover. Tom, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Pamela. I enjoyed it.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Alexandra Alter is here now with Notes from the Publishing World. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
Do you have good news for us?
I do. So, well, it depends. Do you get to fly first class much?
No, it's
okay.
Bad news.
So
all right.
Bad news for
do
you.
Do continue for those first class listeners.
I certainly don't get to fly first class very often, but it turns out we are seriously missing out on some stuff. Not just the better food and the bigger seats and the free champagne. They also have better writing in their in-flight magazine, at least if you fly on United Airlines, which has this luxury magazine called Rhapsody, which publishes stuff from all the writers that you would look for in the bookstore: Karen Russell, Anthony Doerr, Joyce Carol Oates, Amy Bloom, Rick Moody, at least 30 writers that you and I have probably heard of and read, are writing original material for Rhapsody. And this magazine was started a year and a half ago. One of its top editors came out of publishing, Sean Manning. He has edited 5 anthologies and published a memoir, so he's highly connected in the publishing world. And their goal is sort of to add kind of a patina of sophistication to their first-class service, yet another thing that the economy passengers don't get.
So what are they publishing? Are they travel narratives? Are they stories?
Yes,
poetry?
Exactly. It's mostly travel related. I mean, there's travel narratives, which are sort of personal essays. There's sort of cultural dispatches. And I think one of the carrots that they get to hold out to writers is they send them to these fabulous places. They, you know, comp their airfare and put them up in luxury accommodations. And sometimes their writers are able to go to places they want to go to do research. Rick Moody got to go to this remote part of Ireland, and he's going to write about it in a memoir that he's working on. Sloane Crosley got to go to the Turks and Caicos to go to a food festival. So I think, you know, writers have some control over where they're going, and they get to write with a lot of voice and style. That's one of the sort of perks of writing for Rhapsody.
Would you like Rhapsody to send you?
Oh, Bhutan maybe, or I don't know. Let me think about that. I don't know if I'm quite up to the level of some of the writers they're looking for. The reason that Rhapsody caught my eye, though, and I thought it would be an interesting publishing story, is that it sort of fits into this trend that we're seeing where publishers and writers are aligning themselves with corporations and brands more and more.
A shabby chic cachet to the to the literary writer.
I was going to say there's kind of a symbiosis going on. You know, it might seem weird for an airline to be a patron of the arts, or for a company like Chipotle, which, you know, is a fast food company, to have original works by writers like Toni Morrison and Jeffrey Eugenides and Barbara Kingsolver on its disposable cups and paper bags, which it has. But in a way, you can see why the writers want to align themselves with companies and the companies want the writers. The writers get access to a new audience. They'll get paid for their work, but they get their work out there. Meanwhile, the companies sort of get this sheen of sophistication from working with these writers, and they give something new to their customers, something to engage them. The Chipotle project is called Cultivating Thought, and I give them major style points for not calling it Food for Thought, which would have been the obvious way to go. But you've probably seen some of these other partnerships. Like if you go into a Warby Parker store, they have books on the shelves that they're selling by 14 independent publishers. And if you go to the Ace Hotel, I don't know if you ever stay there in New York, they have a writer's residency program where a writer gets to spend the night there for free, and they have to write a letter, and those letters get distributed to the guests, so the guests get to read a letter by one of their residents. People like Atticus Lish and Elif Bateman and Del Peck have all been residents there.
There was also news of McSweeney's doing an interesting kind of fundraising campaign, right, to win an email from
That's right. No, I mean, that's another great example of literature showing up in unusual places. So McSweeney's, as you know, has turned itself into a nonprofit, and as a result, they're able to run Kickstarter campaigns now. And they had some really quirky prizes. For example, you can pay $750 to have a week's worth of email correspondence with Nick Hornby. So you might actually be getting, if you can pony up $750, you could get some of this original writing in your inbox.
So for those not rich enough to get an email from Nick Hornby, who may be able to, you know, afford a Toni Morrison cup from Chipotle, is there any way for them to get a copy of Rhapsody magazine? Can the hoi polloi read this thing, or is it only if you fly first class?
So, you know, it's got, they say, exposure to 2 million passengers and people in lounges. You can read it online, which doesn't give you quite the same experience because it's on very glossy paper with beautiful photographs. So I'm afraid if you want to hold the physical copy, you've got to pony up for first class.
All right. Well, some readers are fancier than others. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Ruth Franklin is here to talk about Shirley Jackson's non-horror side. She writes an essay in this week's book review about Shirley Jackson's domestic essays. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Paola.
So you are writing a biography of Shirley Jackson, I should say up front, and I've obviously read all of her work. Where does this fit in to Shirley Jackson's
career? Well, it's funny because most people have only heard of Jackson's horror writing, but that actually occupies a pretty small percentage of her work. She wrote 6 novels in a variety of different genres and dozens of short stories and these 2 household memoirs that we're talking about. So her range actually was very diverse.
So the first book is Life Among the Savages, which came out in 1953, and Raising Demons in 1957. I'm assuming that because there was a second volume, the first volume did well.
The first volume was a major bestseller. These stories actually, these books are compiled from magazine stories that she wrote for women's magazines from the late 40s through the 50s for Raising Demons. So many readers would already have read and loved these stories and gotten to know Jackson's children. And through them, at least they felt so.
So some of them appeared in Mademoiselle, and what other magazines were these in?
Exactly. Mademoiselle, Woman's Home Companion, Ladies' Home Journal, Collier's, all the staples of the 50s.
Back in the day when some very great women writers were in those, appeared in those pages.
That's right, and they also were paid handsomely for their contributions.
And Jackson was the primary breadwinner in her family.
That's right. And that's one of the things that makes her so unusual for her time, both as a woman and as a writer in general. Then, as now, many writers couldn't make a living simply by their words alone. And many of them, like Jackson's husband, Stanley Edgar Hyman, had teaching positions, did lectures on the side, all the things that writers today are so used to doing. Jackson actually was only a writer.
And one of my favorite facts is that she had four children.
That's right.
And managed to write all of this.
In fact, there's a hilarious piece that's included in Life Among the Savages. It was originally published under the title The Third Baby's the Easiest, which I assume you will find as funny as I do.
Yes.
and it's a laugh-out-loud account of Jackson's labor and delivery with her third child. And there's a very funny, also very telling moment in that piece where she checks into the hospital and the clerk asks her to state her profession. And she says, writer. And the clerk says, I'll just put down housewife. And to me, that just sums up everything you need to know about the position of women writers in the 50s and the struggles she had to go through in order to establish her professional career.
One of the most shocking quotes that you include in your essay, because these were not universally acclaimed among critics, was a quote from Betty Friedan, who accused Jackson of, you say, betraying her readers by contributing to the pernicious myth of the, quote, happy housewife purveyed by women's magazines of the era. And yet Jackson was far from being a housewife.
That's right. And I think Betty Friedan, as I say, is a little hard on Jackson here. She certainly didn't present herself as a professional writer in these pieces. There's nothing in them about her going to her typewriter and typing out her stories. Now, you could say also she didn't have to, because the evidence that she's a professional writer is right there on the page. Her readers are reading these pieces in magazines, in books, and with every knowledge that she wasn't, as one could say, just a housewife. That said, being a housewife was a part of her persona as a writer, as well as of her actual character. She did in some ways identify as a housewife and enjoyed doing so.
One of the things that surprised me about the books is the way that they're organized, that even though they were previously published, presumably with their own titles, that they appear as sort of connected chapters in a long narrative. It's just chapter one, chapter two. It's not, you know, here an essay on kindergarten here and an essay on that there. Is this, do they appear in the same way that they were originally published, or were they changed between their magazine form and the books?
Well, I haven't checked them all to compare, but I think they were pretty much published virtually verbatim in the books. She may have changed a couple of details because the children's ages, if you look closely, don't always correspond with what they were in real life as they were when she wrote the magazine pieces and so on. But they more or less are magazine pieces connected by a few small transitions.
And so for the person who's read The Lottery and The Haunting of Hill House and some of her more well-known novels, is this a recognizable Jackson? Does it feel like it's the same voice and style, or is it quite different in tone?
I think it is recognizable. And one way is that she sort of tips her head to that reader with the epilogue to Life Among the Savages, in which she writes a very funny chronicle of finding a poltergeist in the house. It's written in the style of these 17th century witchcraft chronicles, which she collected and read and then wrote about in a children's book called The Witchcraft of Salem Village. But more than that, I think the style is coherent among all of Jackson's works. She's got a very fine eye for detail. She knows always exactly where to begin a story and where to end it for maximum suspense. And she's got a sense of humor that appears even in her horror fiction.
Yeah, it's very funny. And I wonder if there's a passage that you would particularly want to read, just to give listeners a sense of the Shirley Jackson that one encounters in these books.
Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit from one of Jackson's best-loved family stories. This one appeared in Mademoiselle, amazingly, just less than a month after The Lottery was published. And it's called Charles. It's a story about Jackson's eldest son, who was maybe having a little trouble adjusting to kindergarten and would come home every day with tales of the dastardly deeds that his classmate Charles had committed. And Shirley can't wait to go to school for parent-teacher night and meet the mother of this horrible imp. But when she asks the teacher to introduce her to Charles's mother, she gets a surprise. So I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs here. At the meeting, I sat restlessly, scanning each comfortable matronly face, trying to determine which one hid the secret of Charles. None of them looked to me haggard enough. No one stood up in the meeting and apologized for the way her son had been acting. No one mentioned Charles. After the meeting, I identified and sought out Laurie's kindergarten teacher. She had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of chocolate cake. I had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of marshmallow cake. We maneuvered up to one another cautiously and smiled. "I've been so anxious to meet you," I said. "I'm Laurie's mother." "We're all so interested in Laurie," she said. "Well, he certainly likes kindergarten," I said. "He talks about it all the time." "We had a little trouble adjusting the first week or so," she said primly. "But now he's a fine little helper, with lapses, of course." "Laurie usually adjusts very quickly," I said. "I suppose this time it's Charles's influence."
"Charles?"
"Yes," I said, laughing. "You must have your hands full in that kindergarten with Charles."
"Charles?" she said. "We don't have any Charles in the kindergarten."
That's completely brilliant. You say that in your essay, you compare her or call her in a way a predecessor to today's mommy bloggers. Is she writing about the same thing that today's mommy bloggers write about? Are the concerns the same? Is it just the context that changed?
In some way, I would say yes. She's writing about her children's antics at school, the crazy things they say. In other ways, I think the books do feel recognizably of a different era. One main difference is that her husband really isn't involved in the children's lives in the same way that one expects fathers to be involved today. People would say that he literally never changed a diaper, and I have the feeling that that might actually be true.
Does it feel modern?
As I say in the piece, today's parenting feels so hyper-focused on the children. We have, you know, this phrase, helicopter parenting. There's this pressure to sort of be every place at once and to have a career and to provide cupcakes for every child's birthday. And what feels modern to me actually is Shirley's lack of willingness to participate in all of that. She's not willing to, she doesn't get on the parenting merry-go-round in quite the same way that it feels like we're expected to today. And you can see it just in the titles of these books. The children are savages and demons, and she's sort of telling us to treat them as such, you know, at a very careful distance. It's our own priorities in the end that matter, and we shouldn't organize our life around our children.
Well, that's a very welcome message, I think, probably for both of us and for other listeners as well. Ruth, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela.
That was Ruth Franklin talking about two books by Shirley Jackson, Raising Demons and Life Among the Savages, both of which have just been reissued by Penguin. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What do we have new?
Well, before I talk about the adult bestsellers this week, I wanted to buzz over to the children's list because there are some noteworthy new titles there. On the young adult list, there's a new title debuting at number 2. It's a first novel by a woman. I'm not going to pronounce her last name properly, but it's, I think, Sabah Tahir. It's S-A-B-A-A, and her last name is T-A-H-I-R. It's a fantasy novel called An Ember in the Ashes, about a girl at war who becomes a spy, and it also simultaneously tells the story of a soldier on the other side. It's really getting a lot of great attention. It's drawing comparisons to Harry Potter and to The Hunger Games, kind of a brutal war story. But nice to see a debut novel, you know, making an appearance on the list at all the way up at number 2.
One of the interesting things about that book, too, is that it's the first kind of huge breakout fantasy novel in a while. There's just been that, you know, very much John Green kind of reality fiction thing going on the YA side.
In fact, there hasn't been a lot of movement on the kids' lists at all for a long time. I've been keeping my eye on them thinking, you know, that we'd have something to talk about. And week after week, there's just been nothing new. And so it seemed noteworthy to me that this week there finally were some new books.
Well, another thing that I have to say, a new statistic out there is that sales of children's books in 2014 were up in every single category: picture books, middle grade novels, and YA. So
wow.
There's movement there. And on the middle grade?
On the middle grade list, there's also a couple of new titles. Down at number 9, not surprising to see this one become a bestseller, a book called Hit and Miss by Derek Jeter, writing with Paul Mantel. It's sort of a novelized version of Jeter's own biography. It's a boy's coming-of-age story, how he learned to play baseball and became really, really, really good at it. And then at number 5, kind of a fun book, it's called Rad American Women A to Z. It's by a woman named Kate Schatz. That's S-C-H-A-T-Z. It's an illustrated book. The illustrator is Miriam Klein-Stahl. And what's interesting about this is it's the first children's book ever published by City Lights. City Lights, of course, is the renowned indie bookstore in San Francisco. They've published some adult books along the way. But this is their first children's book, and here it is, new at number 5. It's a collection of 26 short biographies, like one-page biographies, of feminist role models. The author, Kate Schatz, has a daughter, who's now almost 6 years old. But when she was 2 years old, Kate Schatz looked around and said, what books can I give my daughter to inspire her kind of toward feminism? And she couldn't find anything. So she said, I'm going to write it myself. And, you know, it's P is for Patti Smith. F is for
Who's
Florence.
X?
Oh, good question. I do not know who X is.
See, now everyone's going to have to go out and look at it and maybe buy it and figure that out. All right. What about on the grown-up side?
On the grown-up side, there are some new titles, both in fiction and nonfiction. On the fiction side, new at number 15, Carl Ove Knausgård, the Norwegian serial novelist, continues his autobiographical novel, My Struggle, with book 4. It was recently reviewed on our cover by Jeffrey Eugenides. That book is appearing at number 15 on the hardcover list. For all the attention that these books have gotten, the only previous appearance on the bestseller list was for volume 2 in softcover, in paperback. So this is the first hardcover appearance by Knausgård. Then new at number 12, Mary Higgins Clark has a short story collection going all the way back to early in her career, just gathers the short stories she's written, a book called Death Wears a Beauty Mask and Other Stories. Then at number 10, another serial novel, Jane Smiley, has a book called Early Warning. It's the second volume of a trilogy she's planning called the Last Century Trilogy.
Two novels there that are series that you wouldn't normally expect to see among the series bestsellers.
Literary series.
Literary
kind of
series.
Breaking in among the genre series on the list this week. But then you jump all the way up to number 1, and John Sanford is there with a book called Gathering Prey, which is also part of a series. It's the 25th volume of his Prey series, featuring the detective Lucas Davenport. So more the kind of series that we're used to seeing.
Maybe the 25th Knausgård, My Struggle, will make it on there as well. All right. What about nonfiction?
In nonfiction, there are just 2 new titles this week. At number 9, the celebrated neurologist Oliver Sacks has a memoir called On the Move. Sacks, of course, announced in the pages of the New York Times a few months ago that he is in the last stages of terminal liver cancer and is not expected to live more than another few months.
They moved this book up, actually, from a November release to this month.
Yeah, so that he could see it be published still in his lifetime. There it is at number 9. Obviously, that announcement is driving some of the interest in that book, but Sacks has been a best-selling author going many years back, so it probably would have been there anyway. Then at number 1, a book called Hope, written by Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus with Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan. The authors, Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, were 2 of the women kidnapped in Cleveland and held for 10 years. They're their co-captive. Michelle Knight had a book published last year called Finding Me that also was a bestseller. And so now these two are taking their turn and telling their part of the story.
Now, four people can say at the same time that they are number one bestsellers on the nonfiction side of the New York Times bestseller list. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.